Thank you, Hill. I am Mo Holler, and I am an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. And through God's grace and the tremendous love of God, and especially the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, the association with people like yourself, I'm here in sober, and for that I'm very grateful. And I really feel that when I say I'm grateful, I really feel grateful. I had a little old girl tell me the other day that gratitude's an action. And when I think of that, you know, I see action here tonight, people at AA meetings. And the only good thing about ever getting to talk at one of these things is to be able to look at all the faces out in the audience and to see people that you haven't even met that you love, because you see that look on their face. And I'm really grateful for that. You know, we started off tonight, I don't know what kind of night it's going to be. The guy gets up and wants everybody, all these alcoholics, to go look at snakes. I done seen all I want to see. And then... then on top of that, the chairman falls off the podium. Ain't one thing left for me to do, and that's throw up, I guess. So, you better back off. Lord have mercy. Anything liable to have around one of these places. But, you know, I am really grateful to be here, and I want to congratulate you on the 15th anniversary of the Altoona Roundup. And, you know, what I was thinking about just riding over here tonight, 15 years of a lot of love, a lot of God, a lot of caring, a lot of sharing. And, boy, that's tremendous. If you just stop and think about all the people's lives that have been affected just by the Altoona Roundup. Boy, that's overwhelming when you really think about that. And I'm really grateful for that. And I appreciate Groves calling and inviting me to come down. It just thrills me to death when somebody invites me somewhere. You know, I went a lot of years and nobody asked me to go nowhere. And most of the time I showed up, they asked me to leave. I had a big fancy wedding about a week ago at this big country club in Nashville, and my cousin Jim, he just celebrated 12 years of sobriety, and he and I used to drink together and run together, and man, it was a mess. And he was there, and he punched me, and he said, "Good Lord, Hoss, we've been here 4 hours, and ain't nobody asked us to leave." And that wouldn't mean anything to anybody unless you're an alcoholic. But, man, they was always asking me to leave. But, boy, I'm grateful. My wife, Jackie, would love to be here. And things happen. You know, Monday she come up with some bad deals, and she had to go in for surgery. And so she was operated on Monday and got her home, and she's healing up. You know, I say it's minor surgery, and she says it's major. You know, it's minor when it's on somebody else and major when it's on you. But she is hanging in there, and said to extend her love to all of y'all, especially the Al-Anons and the AAs. But she's doing fine. She's getting better. And my daughter has been away this summer working up in Louisville, Kentucky, doing an internship on her graduate work. She's going to graduate in December from Western Kentucky. And Cassie got home today, so she's taking care of Mama. I called them right before I came over, and I know right this minute they're praying for me that I'll say something that will help another alcoholic or an Al-Anon. And boy, that's a good feeling to have your family praying for you. And so I'd planned on bringing my drunk son-in-law with me. I call him my drunk son-in-law. He claims he's been sober 13 years, but he's a pharmacist, and I'm around him a lot, and I watch him. He licks his fingers a lot. I ain't real sure about him, but what a tremendous guy. Jay's his name, and he and I get to fellowship a lot in AA, and that's just a miracle in itself. My daughter, she's got a black belt in Al-Anon, and she's doing great. And again, grandkids are getting raised. My granddaughter's going off to UT to school next week, and so I talked Jay into staying home, because I know when she gets out of there, he's going to really miss us. So I just booked it on down here myself today, and put God in the car and just came on, had the greatest time in the world. It ain't nobody in the world can do that but us. It's beautiful, man. So I've come down here and I've really enjoyed it, and I'm up just a blind, running, stumbling alcoholic. But for God's grace, anything that's going on good in my life, it's through the grace of God. I know that today. Without Him, I'm absolutely nothing. I'm convinced of that today. And you know, there's some things I've heard over the years around the program and different places that reminds me of what I'm like when I'm drinking. There's an old poem I picked up one time, and it says it's a cool evening in October, and I was far from being sober. I was carrying home a load with manly pride when my feet began to stutter, and I fell down in the gutter, and a pig came up and laid down by my side. Now, we were talking of the weather, as when good friends get together, when a lady passing by was heard to say, "Why, you can tell someone that boozes by the company that he chooses." And the pig got up and slowly walked away. You know, I don't know where I ever picked that old thing up, but I know people used to look at me like this. God is awful. And I know there was a story about a guy down in Atlanta by the train station, bumming drinks, and the guy had about an hour before he caught his train, so he bought him in this bar, and he bought him a drink. And the old drunk said, "Where are you headed?" Said, "I'm going to Nashville." "Oh, God, man. Here's my family's phone number. Said, when you get there, call them and tell them, man, that I'm sick, and if they could just send me $200 or $300, I could get back on my feet." He said, "I'll do that. I'll be glad to do that." And he bought him another drink and another drink and another drink. And it was time for that guy to catch his train. So he's going out the door, and that old boy hollered and said, "Hey, don't forget now. Tell that family of mine if they need anything, call me." ain't that typical? I live that way. I was always coming off them drunks humble and servile, and then you put that bug juice in me and you couldn't tell me nothing. "Hey, baby, everything's all right, see? Just got out of jail 3 hours ago." It just changes your whole personality, and I was living my life that way. I was born and raised in Nashville, Tennessee. My mama had 10 kids. There's 7 girls and 3 boys, and we lived in a 2-bedroom house. Had a lot of togetherness in that family. Had the greatest mom and dad in the world, hard-working people. My dad came out of a little country town called McEwen, and he went to work for what eventually became Nashville Electric Service. He worked there 51 years. My mother was a country girl and just so full of love is unbelievable. And they taught me a lot of principles about life and a lot of good things in life. And I really admired my mother and dad. And I really wanted to be a lot like my dad. And the reason I share that is I had all that instilled in me. And I believe the violation of that after the drinking started began to cause me to develop what I call self-hatred. Some people call it low self-esteem. Man, I came to a point where I hated me and what I had become through my disease. And this was long before I knew it was a disease. But I had a great childhood. I grew up on a street just full of kids. They call that little old street I was born and raised on, Little Ireland. And everybody on the street had the CIA disease, Catholic, Irish, alcoholic. And I was always around drinking. It was a way of life around our family. My mother and father wasn't alcoholics, but I had an uncle from down in McEwen, Tennessee, and all he ever did was make whiskey and drink whiskey, as far as I know. Uncle Walter was his name. And I thought Uncle Walter was crazy. I remember him coming up around Christmas time, and one Christmas he threw a pack of firecrackers in my mama's grate, and them hot coals were flying, and I remember her beating him in the back of the head with a broom going out the door. And I remember hearing them talk about Uncle Walter being bad to drink.
Yeah, that's what you called alcoholics back then, I guess.
But I didn't know anything about that. But you know, after I'd been sober for a while, I was talking with one of my sisters one day, and I was trying to share with her how that I could not believe, now that I'm sober, that I look back and alcohol was literally destroying everything in my life that had any meaning to it, and yet I would never admit that drinking had anything to do with it. It was always, if you had to live with her, you'd drink that way too. If you had to work for that guy I worked for, you'd drink like that too. You know, it was always somebody else causing the drinking. And she said, "You're like Uncle Walter." I said, "What do you mean?" She said, "Uncle Walter would be down there and he'd go into DT's in that old country farmhouse, jump up out of the, grab a broom out of the corner, start beating all over the kitchen floor saying he's killing rats." And said one morning they was sitting there drinking and Uncle Walter wasn't really all that drunk, but sure enough a little old mouse run out from under a cabinet, run across the floor, run under another cabinet. He looked around all of them and said, "I got y'all thought I saw a rat, but I didn't." And that's a true story. I guess that must have been the first case of what they call denials, you know. And I know that I was that way too. I would not admit that. Boy, I could not stand the word drinking problem. I hated people that would say that. Drinking ain't my problem, I'd say. And then I'd tell them what all my problems were. All them problems were from my drinking, but I couldn't understand that. And I was caught up in that. Had a great childhood, grew up in a great neighborhood, and I had a natural ability for playing athletics. I ended up down in school in Cullman, Alabama. And some of y'all have heard of Father H, and he taught me in school. I claim he gave me alcoholism. Really, he didn't, but he was a great guy. Knew him well. But I went to school down there, and I don't know how it is in schools now, but back then, if you could play sports, you just passed. And, man, I just loved school. I played sports and passed. Now, the only problem with that, it's a great way to go through school, but you come out stupid. And I've kind of regretted that the rest of my life. But I went to school down there, had a great time, but always drinking was involved in my life. I can remember emptying beer bottles off coffee tables when I was this high, and nobody thought anything about it. I can remember drinking in between that in grammar school, but by the time I was in high school, drinking was a big deal. You know, that's when I began to go to Birmingham, Alabama with friends that lived there. Their parents would go off. There'd be plenty of booze. We'd get blind running drunk. I began to have problems even in high school as a result of drinking. I had a great opportunity at the end of my junior year to get involved in professional baseball. I'd been to a St. Louis Cardinal tryout camp. I'd been to Boston Red Sox tryout camp. They had even talked to my coaches. But see, my coach was even beginning to see that. And he was getting feedback from home during the summer. And he used to sit me down. I remember after I was back from my senior year, and he said, "Man, they're not going to invest money in you with the lifestyle you're developing." And see, I think I was an alcoholic already. And yet, I wouldn't listen to anybody. And by that time, I was starting to get out of trouble that I should have been in trouble for. People overlooked a lot of things. I ended up in the service, went off to service for 4 years in the Navy. Never will forget it. Went out, got blind running drunk one night. Came home, somebody was beating on my door the next morning. They said, "Come on, man, we got to be down there to go to the Navy." I left home, I had 65 cents and a toothbrush in my pocket. Had a t-shirt on, I was going to San Diego, California, I thought. We ended up going up to, where is that place up in Wisconsin? Green Bay? I froze to death up there. And you know, I really hate to think back at those days, but I was a full-blown alcoholic then. And the next 4 years of my life, you just will take it and put it in a garbage can. You know, that's when this personality change began to develop. Things that had really been important to me in my life, things that I really care about, the principles that I had tried to live by, suddenly those things are all going out the window. Where it used to be that athletics was real important, beer joints became more important. The thought of drinking, I was being preoccupied with it. I caught myself thinking about drinking all during the day. And I never will forget, I was in the service, I was in there for 4 years, and when I was in there about 3.5 years, I was standing on the fantail of a ship down between Key West, Florida and Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, sicker than a dog, done been drunk. And this officer walks up to me and says, "Holland, I want you to climb that A-frame, go out on that boom, and grease those fittings." I looked up there, about 60 foot in the air. I said, "Man, I ain't going nowhere." I said, "I'm having a hard time standing here." He said, "Well, you're either going up there or we're going to bust you." I said, "You bust me and I'm going to be a civilian. I ain't got nothing. I still had what I had when I went in there." And that's pitiful. There was no ambition to achieve anything or anything. It was drink. Couldn't wait to get over there. Ended that last year, take that paycheck, go down there and blow it at them bars. Then start signing chits to drink on. I see a lot of faces that have done that. Next payday, you go down, pay it off, drink up the rest of it, and start signing again, you know. 4 years later, I leave with 65 cents and a toothbrush, and I come home with nothing. With absolutely nothing. And I don't know I'm an alcoholic. I'm going to college. I go up to Middle Tennessee State Teachers College, enroll in pre-engineering. Hell, can't spell it even. And I'll tell you something, you can't sit out at the 41A beer joint every day and get an education. There ain't no professors come out there. And I was getting that government check, and I sit out there every day. Yeah, I'm in college. God, until I fall off one of them stools, you know. An old boy went with me. He's in worse shape than I was. It was absolutely pathetic. I finally went to work for a large company that moved out of Louisville, Kentucky, called Western Electric. And I got a good job with them. Tremendous company, man, and they were brand new in Nashville. I was one of the first people they hired, and I had all kind of opportunities to go right up the ladder. By this time, it was somewhere around 1957, and I was working there. I was married to Jackie, my wife, and we had two kids, and we had a brand new house, brand new automobile, had some money in the bank, and you would think, looking at the all-American couple, that everything was beautiful. But I want to tell you, man, it was falling to pieces. Because I'm an alcoholic. And bad things happen to alcoholics. And, man, all of a sudden it started. Getting them DWIs. I never will forget, I meant to go to work. But I got to throwing up in the parking lot. So a man as ill as that's got to go get treatment. So I went over this beer joint that old Faye Thomas owned, and I was sitting over there drinking that vodka and beer. Man, I was getting drunk about a minute. I finally got up, and there's another place I wanted to go to because they kind of getting tired of me there. I got in that car, and I never will forget, I was going up 8th Avenue. We call it Reservoir Hill in Nashville. And it's got a great big wide sidewalk, and just as I passed Chestnut Street, and you know when you're driving drunk, man, it's awful. It's like digging ditches. You know, them lines are going like this, and you're fighting that thing, and finally I saw them blue lights swing on, and here they come. Well, I just pulled that thing up on the sidewalk, got out, locked it up. When they pulled up, I just threw the keys in the front window. I said, "I'm tired of driving that damn thing in there." And I just opened the back door and laid down the street, just like you're supposed to. They carried me to jail up there, locked me up. Jackie's devastated. My brother-in-law comes up there and pays my bond. He gets me out, takes me home. Everybody's crying up. And it is devastating that first time. Then you start looking forward to who you're going to run into up there. So everything was starting to fall apart in our life. You know, we get to where we can't work because of all these viruses. You know, that was back when them viruses started, and man, I had them all, and I'm calling in, and I was a very unfortunate person. I had 8 uncles die one year. I had to go to a lot of funerals, you know. And you keep calling in and lying like that. Well, then when you go to work, you just feel horrible. You know everybody in there is looking at you. And yeah, I heard an old boy in AA say he got to where he'd go to a football game, and when they got in a huddle, he thought they was talking about him. I felt that way. You know, I'd walk in there, and I knew everybody knew the shape I was in the night before. Most of them could have cared less, but I felt that way. They got to where they would call me in about my attendance record. Because I was missing a lot of Mondays and Tuesdays and Wednesdays. And so they'd call you in there and they'd chew you out for about 2 hours about your attendance record and all this stuff. And then back in those days, they'd never mention you drinking for some reason or other. But right at the very end, some guy would speak up and say, "But I'll tell you one thing. When Holland's on the job, he's one of the best employees we got." And I'm so sick, I walk out that door thinking, when in the world are they going to give me a raise? That is pitiful. That's that alcoholic thinking. Well, man, it's getting so bad. I'm getting so down because by this time, see, I'm getting sick spiritually. I'm getting sick mentally. And then the physical is starting. You know, at one time where I really had a deep relationship with God, man, I started going to church, and I felt so rotten about me, I'd start finding fault with you. I'd get in there, I'd look around, look at that guy all dressed up, been out running around on his wife. I didn't even know the guy. But see, I had to try to feel better about me. And then, you know, I got to where I said, they're down here all dressed up trying to sell somebody something. And, you know, I was just getting sicker that way. One morning, Jackie made me take her to church with the kids. And I was driving down Nolan's Road. I had a can of Budweiser between my legs. Driving down through there, and a guy passed me pulling a bass boat. I looked over. I said, "Look at that guy going fishing on Sunday instead of taking his family to church." Ah, it's pitiful. You know, by this time, I'd walk in church and all the statues would get up and walk out. And you know, people got to where they wouldn't sit beside me. So I finally just judged them all, the hypocrites. I ain't going anymore. And I'm getting sicker that way out of my own personal guilt. Mentally, man, I'm negative in everything that I think about. I find fault with everything, and I'm beginning to feel like the world's against me and that I ain't going to let them get me, and I'm getting that bad attitude. Physically, all this stuff starts going to doctors and getting pills and getting shots. I used to go to one old doctor down there, and never will forget him. He'd give me a shot for the shakes. And he'd look at me, he said, "I think I'll have one too." he'd give him one too. It's insane, man. You know, it's getting worse all the time. I can't stop the drinking. I'm walking the floor by now, screaming, "God, please help me." See, I'm in that trap. I can't get out. There are times when I really want to quit drinking. I'm beginning to see the heartache and disappointment in my wife's eyes. I'm seeing the fear and anxiety in the children's eyes. And I know that everything's falling apart in life. And I don't want to drink, but I end up drinking again.
The utter futility of that just runs you crazy. There were times when I walked that floor just begging somehow or another to stop. I know now that it wasn't sincere enough, that it was mostly wanting to get out of the trouble I was in and to get the feeling, by the way, I could start drinking again. You know, we call it a disease, and if it's not a disease, I don't know what it is. I can remember sitting at that kitchen table with my wife when she'd say, "Mo, I love you, but I can't live this way anymore. I've got to leave." And I remember sitting there crying and begging her not to do that. "Don't break this family up. I love you and I love the children." And I said, "Jackie, as far as drinking's concerned, it's over. There's not going to be any more drinking." And what's sad is I wasn't conning her. I really meant that from the bottom of my heart. And yet within 2 or 3 days, I'm starting to drink again. It's a vicious illness, in my opinion, and it destroys so many other people's lives. And I'm getting sicker all the time. I can't handle my feelings. I'm promising the kids that I'll take them to the park on Saturday morning and feed the ducks, and I'm getting drunk on Friday night. I'm sick when I wake up. I start drinking to feel better. And then I ease out the door and get in the car, and I'm off and running and drinking and drunk and come home and pass out. And, you know, when I'd come to, boy, all that guilt about how could you do that to your own children. And, boy, I'd be so ashamed. And I didn't know how to handle that. The only thing I knew to do was to take another drink. And once I could get enough of that in me, I could justify what I'd just done. I said, them kids would rather be playing with other kids around the neighborhood than to go off with you. And I'd believe these things, see, until the booze would run out. And then all that guilt, all that fear, all that anxiety, all that shame would start coming back on me. And even though I was at times did not want to drink, I could not not drink. And I ended up drinking again. I just couldn't stop it. Jackie was hanging on by a thread, trying to hold that family together, trying to keep the pieces together. How in the world they do it, I don't know. I remember I left to go to a football game at the Clinic Bowl football game at Vanderbilt Stadium, me and another boy, blind running drunk, got half pints hanging all over us, you know, and here we come. Went in that football game over there, drinking that whiskey, and didn't know where I was at. I remember coming out, they don't remember nothing about the football game. Come out there and had that old mustard running down me and everything. And my stomach started swelling up, and I started throwing up these coffee grounds. And I told that old boy, I said, "I ain't ever drinking no more coffee." This was on a Thursday, Thanksgiving Day, and I kept swelling up and throwing up. I had to be at work at that time on Friday. I went in Friday. I was swelling up and throwing up all day long. It's old black coffee ground. Finally went up to the nurse and told her what was going on. She said, "You have got serious problems, and I'm going to write a name of a doctor down, and you put it in your wallet, and you go right now and get help." I left there, went straight down to the liquor store, got me a pint, went up there on Thompson Lane in Nashville at the Bamboo Club, and sit up there and just swell up and throw up and drink. I don't know what time I got home, but sometime during the night, I just collapsed in the bathroom. And my wife came in there, and I wasn't unconscious, and I told her about that doctor's name. She called this doctor, and he said, "Get him to the hospital immediately." Her brother came and picked me up, and they took me to St. Thomas Hospital. Sometime during the night, this little doctor came in there, and he said, "Mr. Holland, you have hemorrhaged internally. You're bleeding to death. You got duodenal ulcers, and I can't stop the bleeding." They had tubes running all in me and everything, and he said, "I'm going to have to do surgery." They took me upstairs sometime during the night. To make a long story short, they cut out 3/4 of my stomach. I went from about 172 pounds down to about 127 pounds. I'm laying there in that bed the day that he's discharging me from that hospital. And as he's walking out the room, I say, "Doc, by the way, every now and then, watching a ball game on TV or cutting the grass, I enjoy a few drinks. Would that be all right? He said, oh, it'll be fine. I turned around to Jackie. I said, you heard what that doctor said. I don't want to hear no more about this drinking. Now, boy, that is disease. There ain't nobody in the world, non-alcoholic, would do that. I'm almost dead. I leave that hospital, go by gym courses. I get 3 cases of beer and go to my sister's house with a hospital gown on and sit in her basement and get drunk right after surgery. Then I go home. I'm sitting in the chair drunk. The nurse is coming out there to see me. She's asking me what's wrong. I said, it's that medicine. Man, and it smelled like a brewery in there. I'm drunk. And I'm running out of strings, man. I don't know what to do. And Jackie's going crazy. The drinking's getting worse. I finally just quit that job. I just called in and they said, well, what is it this time? I said, I'm drunk. In fact, I'm drunk. And I said, I quit. Do you know they came out and tried to help me? They, 2 guys from that place of business, begged me to get some sleep, clean up, and come into work. I want to tell you, I was too ashamed to. I was too ashamed. I said, send me whatever you got to send me. I'll sign it, but I'm through. I'm got some money in the bank, unemployed, wife, 2 kids, start getting into what I call oblivion drinking. You ever been there? The only peace of mind I had was when I was unconscious. And I didn't drink to have fun, to party, to laugh. I drank to pass out. Ordering whiskey from a cab company, getting on 3 and 4 and 5 day benders down in the bed. Can't get out of the bed with it. By this time, Jackie would take the kids and the car and all that stuff, and she'd leave and either go to one of my sister's houses or her mother's house until I'd get over that bender. And that's the kind of drinking I was doing, that oblivion drinking. And one morning she came back, and I was sitting at the kitchen table, and I said, Jackie, I said, God, I believe I'm losing my mind. She said, good Lord, that's the smartest thing you've said in 3 years. And she got on the phone, called this Catholic priest. The Catholic priest called this psychiatrist. The next thing I know, I'm sitting over there in front of this psychiatrist's desk over there, and he's saying, what's your problem, son? And I'm sitting there about dead, and I start telling him the truth. I said, man, I'm drinking myself to death. I said, I get up, and that radio's playing. I turn it off. It plays. I unplug it. It plays. I put it in the closet, and it plays. He said, hold it. Do not say you're an alcoholic. Something in your childhood is causing you to drink it. Now, this is in 1957. So he said, I can fix it. Well, they load me up and took me out to a place called Madison Sanitarium, and they plugged me in a wall out there. You ever had shock treatment? I was the original Pac-Man. You know, back then, people just didn't know. He thought some traumatic thing happened in childhood caused me to drink. If he could knock that memory thing out, I was going to be... It's the scariest thing in the world. It ain't painful, but I mean, that's 6 guys walk in your room with these white coats. They look like grave diggers, man. And there's 3 on each side holding you down. Here come that big psychiatrist with a thing look like a battery charger. He runs it up behind your bed where you can't see him. He got these things look like hockey pucks that we used to shoot in them beer joints, and they got wires on them. And he puts them here, flips that switch, and son, it's Irene Goodnight. That's the end of that deal. Well, you're supposed to have 21 of them things. If they'd have gave me 21 of them things, you couldn't have shook my hand tonight. And my brother and wife found out what they was doing to me, come out there, got me out of there, thank God, took me to the VA hospital. Well, VAs have got good programs now, but back then they didn't know nothing about alcoholism. Everything was lockup time. You know, there wasn't... I can't believe treatment centers that have doors open. First time I seen one, I said, "Why, you ain't going to be able to keep no drunks out here." So next thing you know, I'm at the VAC, and I'm sitting around there with all that electricity in me, about to come unglued. Here come a guy with a big tray, got a big old white cup on, said, "Mr. Holland, that's yours." I look in there, all these different colored pills look like an Easter basket. I took that thing, swallowed it down. Son, 11 o'clock, I'm down there bowling in the bowling alley. And thought everything was fine. Had a nice lunch sitting around up there. I was getting wired again. And about 3 o'clock, here come again. Another Easter basket. 4 o'clock, son, I'm making leather pocketbook. Ashtray. Yeah, putting them big bull horns on that. And I'm so sick, I'm sitting there thinking, I hope she appreciates this. Talking about my wife. God, I ain't worked in 2 years. And back in those days, of course, Thorazine was the big drug in those places. And so everybody there had the Thorazine shuffle. You know, you just walk on your heel. Like that. I mean, everybody walked. Even the staff walked that way. And so I'm in that place, and I'm leaning up against the wall one day. Everybody did that, too. And some guy had a white coat, and he said, "Mr. Holland, you're doing great." I said, "Yeah." He said, "We're going to let you go home on the weekend." He said, "You leave here Friday and go home with your family and come back by 8 o'clock Monday morning." Well, I go home, stay drunk Friday night, all day Saturday night, Sunday, come in there Monday. Man, I'm a wreck, flying all to pieces. Here come that Easter basket. 11 o'clock, I'm down there bowling again. I don't know how long I stayed out there. I really don't know. My wife is going crazy. You know, she thinks I'm getting cured, see? Well, they didn't know what to do with me, so finally, one time, I never will forget, I was still in that oblivion drinking. I was back there in the... What's the time, dude? Out drinking again, just falling to pieces, and Jackie had left with the kids and all that, so I heard a banging on the back door, and I don't know how long I'd been on this drunk, but I went to the back door and opened it, and my oldest sister was standing there, and I never will forget the horrible look on her face, see, but she said, "I don't want to see you or anybody in my family. Just leave me alone." I slammed that door and I locked it. And boy, that's hurt a lot of times in my life. But when I turned around, there was blood in that sink. It was all over the stove, table, walls. I'd been in there in a blackout, falling into furniture and tables. And never, I don't know how many days I'd been in there. I was about dead. Sometime late that night, my brother-in-law called me and said he wanted to come out and see me. And I said, "I don't want to see you or anybody." He said, "Well, I had 3 or 4 cases of beer and a fifth of whiskey and nothing." I said, "Come on out, Andy." I said, "You're the only one in the family I care anything about." That's pitiful, man. He comes out with all this stuff to drink, starts telling me about this hospital they had in Nashville. Says, "Most wonderful thing you ever seen. Man, they rub you down, they give you vitamins, and you come out there, you just feel like $1 million. And we sit up all night, me drinking and him talking. So the next day, we get in his car, we go downtown, and he pulls up and stops at the courthouse. He said, "Now, we got to go in here to get everything arranged and everything." And this was back before you had rights. You know, if somebody's fed up with you, they just go to town, swear out a lunacy warrant on you, and you're gone, man. I walk in this judge's chambers, and the judge, I grew up with him. And so I'm walking in, my whole family's there, the family lawyer's there. I said, man, just anybody can't get in that hospital. That's alcoholic. And I remember Judge Boone kept asking me, do you know what you're doing? Well, I'm drunk. Yeah, I know what I'm doing. I signed them papers, you know. They bring me downstairs, told me to get in the paddy wagon. I said, I got my car. He said, you don't go out there like that. Boom, in that paddy wagon, peeping out that little window, took me to this hospital they call a hospital. It ain't a hospital because it's got asylum rolled up over the door. It's an old board, old Davidson County Hospital. They bring you in there and they take your picture and they fingerprint you. They start you down this long hall, locking and unlocking them doors. They put me down there on Ward 10. Threw me in a tight room down there, and that whiskey was coming out of me, and I got a little bit of claustrophobia anyhow. Man, I was begging them to let me out of that tight room. I begged them all night, all the next day. Finally, the following night, they let me out and put me in the big dormitory. 15 minutes later, I begged them to put me back in that tight room. That's the wildest place you ever seen. You know, it was just pitiful. It was about 6 drunks out there, and the rest of them totally insane. You know, I mean, you didn't turn your back to nobody in there. They take a bedpan and wear your head out. And it was pitiful. You know, they're eating cigarette butts off the floor, and it was just a horrible thing. It's a snake pit. Anybody in the world that experienced that would never drink again. But an alcoholic, he'll resent, and he'll get drunk at them every time for putting him in a place like that. And, man, I was beginning to hate everybody. And in that place, you know, you say, I want to use the phone. You don't use the phone. I want to write a letter. You don't write no letter. And the first guy I asked, how long you been here? He said, 6 years. I said, oh, God. And I'm in that place. I can't get out. And they had a foreign doctor. I couldn't understand him. I try to explain how sane I was. And the more I talked, the more insane I sounded. And finally, though, one day I told him, I said, Doc, I said, look, I'm one of the finest chefs that they've ever had in the United States Navy. If I could just work in the kitchen, it would help rehabilitate me. And he bought it. I couldn't fry an egg. But somebody told me that somebody working in that kitchen one time run off from that place. And I wasn't over there 2 days, and I found that little old construction door that they'd leave open at certain hours. And I put that apron in a GI can, and son, I was long gone. And it's amazing. I never will forget this as long as I live. I was going across the Bordeaux Bridge trying to get back to Nashville. That's the Cumberland River. A sheriff's patrol car was coming this way. And I swear, if he would have stopped, I'd have went off in that river and took my chances. I would have. I would not have gone back there. I left there. I got drunk. To make a long story short, I ended up back in front of that judge. He dropped all the charges. I promised him that I'd never see him again, you know, as we do. I left there. I had started at that time to try AA. I had a nephew of mine and an uncle of mine that had bought me the dry-out joints, and they'd drive me out, and they introduced me to a guy I knew real well named Cherry C, and Cherry made the first 12-step call on me and started taking me to AA. Never will forget how that happened. He come out to visit us that night. We're sitting in the living room on the floor because I'd burnt the house down. And Cherry starts telling me about AA, and I told him I can't listen. I'm too nervous. I'm shaking. I need something to calm my nerves. He called a doctor friend of his, and he called in a prescription. They went down there and got it, and it looked like that stuff they used to give me in them dry-out joints, that Irene Goodnight. It was in a old green-looking stuff. So he left that bottle that said take a half a teaspoon every 6 hours. And he said, that'll settle you right down. He went out that door, son. I sucked that thing down. knocked me cold in a cucumber, you know. And that's how I started going to AA. But I was going to get everybody off my back. I didn't want to listen to that hassle anymore. And I'd go to AA for a few meetings, and I'd sit on that back row, and I yes butted everything they said. Not me. Yes but. And I didn't hear a thing. And I'd leave there, and I'd get on one of them drunks again. And then I'd come back, and they'd suggest maybe you need to change your friends that you're running around with. And my attitude was so rotten, I'd say, man, I ain't giving up my friends for nobody. And then I'd go out and I'd hang with them friends, and then I'd get drunk and in jail and all messed up. And here I'd come dragging back in there. It wasn't long that I was on another one of them bad drunks. I had that stomach problem, and I went out on Galton Road to a doctor. He gave me a whole bottle of phenobarbital for my stomach problems. And I was eating them things like popcorn, and I pulled in a beer joint. I pulled in a place. I said, I'm going to drink a beer like any normal human being. I went in there, drank that beer, paid for it, come outside, got in my car, pulled out of that lot, turned right, turned right, turned right, pulled in there and parked in the same place. I drank two more. I got 2 6-packs to go. You know where I went? Went out to Bordeaux, sit on the hood of the car, cussed them people, throw the cans over the fence. Left there blind, running, drunk, went to this old place I used to hang out called the Spook House. Got down there blind, running, drunk. All that I know that happened, the next thing I know, telephone poles are flying in the air. I hear squealing sounds. I see flashing lights. I guess it's what kids have a trip on acid. I was seeing all this stuff, and the next thing I know is two policemen sitting on top of me, and my skin was all off the side of my head. They had held me down in a gutter and me trying to root out from under them. One of the policemen knew me, and he said, Mo, what's wrong with you, man? I said, I don't know. Drunk, I guess. He said, there's more wrong with you than drunk. And they got me up, took me to jail, took me to General Hospital, took me back to jail, and the next morning they had a hold on me, and they took me out to Lentz Health Clinic, and I never will forget it. I'm sitting there between two policemen in Lentz Health Clinic. Old Dr. Lentz came out, and I never will forget. He looked me right in the eye, and he said, what's the sea level of Nashville? I said, my God, I didn't know there's a sea around here. I didn't know what that man's talking about. He started asking me where Roosevelt spent his summer vacations. I'm sitting there about dead, man. I weigh about 116 pounds, eyes all sunk back in my head. And finally he said, what you need is 11 months and 29 days on the county road. And I never will forget this, and I believe God did this for me. I looked up at him and I said, Dr. Lentz, don't you know that if I could volunteer to go to jail for 1 year and be guaranteed that I'd never have to drink again, that I'd be the first guy to volunteer? And something clicked in that old man's mind. He went back to his office. My sister and my wife were back in, and they talked him out of sending me to the county road. And you know where I went? Back to Bordeaux. God, I done run off from there. I get out there, but they've changed doctors. Got a woman doctor. I'm sitting there, been there 2 days, sitting on a bench. She came up, said, how's the medication making you feel? I ain't taking no medication. What's wrong with you? I don't know. They say I'm an alcoholic. She said, let me check your records. She went down to her office. She came back up, and she said, they are right. She said, but you're sober, and I can't do anything for you. You call some of your friends or some of your family to come out here and sign for you, and I'm going to let you go. God, I was thrilled to death, man. This is part of the story I don't even like to tell. 6 hours later, I'm still out there. I can't get nobody to come get me. You know, we run the string out eventually. You know, it's not that people don't love us. It's the utter futility of trying to help us. And I'd run the string out. I heard my sponsor told a story that always reminded me of my situation then. He said there's an old Irish lady named Margaret married to a guy named Pat, and he was about like me. Married 50 years, and finally old Pat dies, and they got him waked over at the funeral home. And Margaret standing at the head of the casket, and all the old Irish women are coming through. And they say, oh, Margaret, he looks so wonderful. Looks like when he was in grammar school. And that old lady just nodded her head. Another one came through and said, oh, Margaret, he looks so wonderful. Looks so good in that suit and tie. And old Margaret just nodded her head. Another one came through, oh, Margaret, he looks so wonderful. Looks like the day you married him. And she patted his hands and said, my God, Margaret, he even feels warm. She said, hot or cold, that SOB goes out of here at 10 o'clock this morning. She had had all that cat she wanted. And, you know, that's what I'd done. I had hurt people beyond their ability to respond. That's pitiful. And, you know, I got out of there. She finally said, sign yourself out. And I left, and I couldn't stop it. I almost burned up twice in fires. And then finally I came to an emergency room hollering, God, please help me. Just literally about dead. I was half in hysterics, half drunk, hair burned off, blisters all over my face. Again, they kept calling. Nobody would come. Finally, one brother-in-law that hadn't been around me much came down and got me out of that hospital. Took me to my sister's house. She let me stay upstairs for 2 days. 3 days it was. And up there is when it was like a motion picture of my life going in front of me. And man, for the first time in my life, I could really see what this disease had done to my life. You know, there wasn't any more games. There, you know, the reality of that, all the heartache, disappointment, the pain, the problem, is when I was drinking. And I could see that for the first time. I remember getting on my knees saying, God, please let me stay sober or let me die. And I really meant that night. And finally I walked back up them steps at 47½ Union Street, and I was met by a guy named George Goodall, who's passed away now. I never will forget, he said, raise your head, smile, shake hands with these people. Who knows, you might have had your last drink. And boy, they started loving me back to health. I had so many people start teaching me the steps. Back in those days, sponsorship, as we talked about here, was so strong. I remember riding with my sponsor, and I hadn't been sober long. Was riding up Broad Street, and he said, Mo, how you get along with people? I said, oh, Joe, I get along with people great. He said, what about people that disagree with you? I said, to hell with them. He didn't say nothing. He just kept driving. He just let me sit in that. And finally, after a while, he looked over and he said, that's the kind of thing we work on in AA. And boy, he was such a teacher. And Joe and myself, he started bringing me on 12-step calls, and life started getting good, and I started comprehending this program, and I began to feel that love, that unconditional love. I never will forget riding home from a meeting one night with a lady named Georgia. And Georgia is still sober. She must be sober 38, 39 years. And I never will forget telling her, I wished I could really identify with God. And I never will forget, she looked me right in the eye. She said, I'm going to give you a little poem, Mo, and she said, I want you to run it through your mind till it has some meaning. And she said, I sought my God I could not see. I sought my soul eluded me. I sought my fellow man and found all three. I laid up there that night and run that through my mind, and I thought about when I was the most unlovable human being in the world. When I had absolutely nothing to offer any other human being, when I walked up them steps at 47½ Union Street, I was met with unconditional love. And I began to connect that love with God working through people. And that relationship has deepened and grown as the time has gone on in sobriety. I can't tell you how good it is. You know, I thank God all the time that He saved my life. But you know what I thank Him most for? For the life He's given me in sobriety. Boy, that's what's beautiful, to experience that. My daughter, married to a recovering alcoholic, we have AA all the time. My oldest son is living out in Dallas, Texas, got a brand new baby that I love better than anything. He's doing great in life. I got Cassie, my youngest baby. She's youngest. She's 22, getting out of college, and just got home today. And God has really blessed our life. And AA has been such a way of life for us. You know, AA is my life, and then everything else falls around the perimeter of that. I can't fit AA into my life. And you know, even though things have been great, you and I know we have to learn to accept life on life's terms. And I'm going to share a personal thing with you tonight, and I want you to really realize I'm not sharing that out of wanting sympathy. I'm sharing that out of maybe being able to demonstrate, especially to newer people in the program, the tremendous power of God that's available to every one of us in this program. God will do for us what we cannot do for ourselves. Years ago, I was working as a counselor out at Cumberland Heights, a large treatment center in Nashville, and a guy came there for treatment. Reminded me a lot of me. He had been just a low bottom alcoholic. And he told me, he said, "Mo, I'll stay, but it ain't gonna help. I've been through all these things." And he said, "I just can't stay sober." But he did stay, and through God's grace and love and that atmosphere that was out there, he began to respond to the program. He began to understand. And I used to walk to the gate with him a lot and share with him. And coming back one night, he kept showing me a picture of his little girl and how much he loved her. And she was valedictorian of a senior class and had a scholarship to the University of Alabama. And he shared with me in tears that he'd never been a part of her life. He'd been a part of all the other kids' lives, but this little girl, the disease had shut her plumb out of his life. And he felt so much guilt from that. And he said, "If I could just leave treatment one day early, I could be at her graduation." And so I made those arrangements, and Bill went to her graduation. He got active in his home group down there in his small hometown. He started chairing meetings, helping alcoholics, and building a relationship with this little girl. It was unbelievable. They did everything together. And one morning I was eating breakfast, and I had a phone call, and it was Bill on the phone. That little girl had been killed in a car wreck. And I said, "Bill, I'll be there right now." And he said, "Mo, that's not necessary." He said, "A drink hadn't even entered my mind. For the first time in my life, I'm in a position to be of strength and help to my wife and my other children, and I've never been that in my life." He said, "Right now, my house is full of AA people. It's full of Al-Anon people. They're supporting us and loving us, and we're going to be just fine." I remember sitting down and couldn't finish breakfast. All I could think about is the truth that's in Alcoholics Anonymous. And boy, I began to realize the power available. Here's a guy that couldn't stay sober with the least little thing going wrong, and yet God gave him that power. I went and spoke on his first birthday and his second birthday and his third birthday. And the night I spoke at his third birthday, his whole family was sitting in the front row. And as I was talking, I was looking at him. I've never seen such peace on people's faces. And usually I get out of there real fast, jacking myself, because it's such a long drive back to Nashville and I have to work the next day. But we got caught up in the kitchen with him that night eating cake, his birthday cake. And boy, they began to share with us about faith. Boy, I mean, it was unbelievable. We drove home that night. That's all Jackie and I could talk about, was the faith that's available if we just reach out and take it. And so we didn't have any idea, see, that God was just preparing us. Following Saturday, our 19-year-old son gets killed in a car wreck. And the first person I think of is Bill. And all of a sudden, boy, I started thinking about what he shared and what his wife shared. And I began to share that, and Jackie and myself began to share that together. I had a daughter at that time living in Tampa. I had a son in Dallas. My little girl, who's 22 now, was 13, and she had spent the night away from home. I had to go get her and me and her mother and sit down and tell her that in the car. And you can't imagine, although some can. And yet I knew God was there all the time. And just like Bill, my house immediately was filled with AA people. God, I'll never forget my sponsor. All through that deal at the funeral home, every time I looked around, he was leaning against the wall. I looked this way, he was sitting in a chair. He was always there. Never said anything. He was always there through that whole deal. I never will forget the way God begins to heal. I was driving down to church to the funeral service, and my little girl, 13, said, "Daddy, I had a dream last night." And I said, "Well, what'd you dream?" She said, "I dreamed I died and went to heaven. And the first person I saw was John." And said, "Boy, we took off and we wrapped up and we hugged each other. And we had never been as happy in all our life. And all of a sudden we looked down and you and Mama were crying. And we wanted so bad to be able to tell you that everything was all right. But we couldn't tell you." Out of a 13-year-old little girl's mouth, that came, and the healing started. And we knew that we knew God don't make mistakes. And all of a sudden, our family got together. We all started really helping one another, sharing with one another, talking about all the good things about John and the days we had with him. And it's been a long time. The first year's the hardest. And yet that healing has taken place. Don't mean I don't still cry about him when I get real tired sometime. And coming home from work, and I might cry for 15 miles, and that's all right. I really miss him. I get to thinking about him being married and with kids and all that. But that's the power of God, see. And let me tell you something. I know that I don't have that power. I know I don't have the power to stay sober. See, that's what that first step means to me. I'm powerless over alcohol. Don't mean I'm going to get drunk if I drink. It means I will definitely drink unless I maintain that source of power in my life. And that's why I'm here tonight, so I can receive that power from you. And God bless you. I don't know how long I talk. I hope I ain't wore you out, but I love you. God bless you, and thank you for listening to me.